Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. Today, we're going to take a look at the dark side. The dark side of America's intelligence community. The 1950s CIA programs like MKUltra, where thousands of people were unsuspecting subjects of human experimentation. Journalist and author Stephen Kinzer, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe, joins us today to talk about his new book, Poisoner in Chief. It's a profile of Sidney Gottlieb, one of the most powerful and unknown figures in the Cold War. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. Great people like Joe Carson, Alice Carlson, Marvin Rasmussen, and Susan Lewis. Will you join them? All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page, and it's easy to go from there. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we talk about one of America's most powerful but little known figures in the Central Intelligence Agency, a man who was responsible for developing poisons for assassination efforts. His name was Sidney Gottlieb, and journalist Stephen Kinzer has written a powerful biography called Poisoner in Chief: Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Stephen Kinzer joins us today. He writes columns for the Boston Globe. He spent many years as a correspondent for the New York Times, and this is his 10th book. He lives in Boston and joins us today. Stephen Kinzer, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
And let me tell you that I have read your work for many years and often agreed with the opinions that you offer. And this is my first opportunity to speak to you. I did trade emails with you a couple of times trying to schedule something, and it never worked out. So I'm very pleased to be able to talk with you today.
Well, keep trying. I'm glad we managed to connect.
So what drew you to this story about Sid Gottlieb?
I've been spending a good deal of my career trying to figure out what goes on behind the facade of public politics and public diplomacy that we see. In my writings, I've come up with a fair number of surprising episodes, and they may have shocked some people, but this is the first time I've been shocked. I'm still in shock by what I discovered in writing this book. So I came to it actually through a project that was connected to an earlier book that I wrote. In that book, I included a short section about an episode that happened in 1960. The President of the United States, Dwight Eisenhower, ordered the assassination of Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, and the CIA then created poison and sent it to the CIA station in the Congo for use in assassinating Lumumba. So I wrote this story, and then I began asking myself, later on, after that whole project was finished, so who was that guy? Somebody carried poison made by the CIA to another country with the government-ordered mission of using it to assassinate the leader of that country. So who was that guy? Was he some kind of a courier? No, I find out he was not a courier. He was a guy named Sidney Gottlieb, who nobody has ever heard of. And he was the chief chemist of the CIA. Upon researching his background a little more, I found, not surprisingly, that he was also the CIA chemist who made poisons to kill Fidel Castro. And he made suicide pills for the U-2 spy plane pilot. But then, as I began researching his life a little bit more fully, I realized that making poisons to kill foreign leaders was actually just a sidelight for Gottlieb. He was just essentially the pharmacist in that story. His most bizarre period at the CIA was the decade that he spent running MKUltra, the CIA's search for mind control. So when I put all of this together, I realized that by telling the story of this American who lived in complete invisibility, I could also tell the story of the most sustained effort in history to find techniques of mind control.
And Stephen, one of the takeaways from your book for me was a new view of Dwight Eisenhower. And I also have to say that I'm in the middle of reading David Talbot's book,
Devil's Chessboard.
Thank you, Devil's Chessboard. And so my impressions of the 1950s, I was born in 53, so it's all received knowledge for me. But I thought of Dwight Eisenhower as this fairly benign figure. I remember his parting comment, the warning about the military-industrial complex. He seemed like that nice country club Republican who mainly focused on playing golf and just kind of keeping the chair warm while he was president. But under his reign, the CIA went really full tilt boogie. And you describe how Sid Gottlieb was given incredible authority. Only one other person was fully briefed on MK Ultra, and he could control his own budget, hire thieves and con men and dirty cops to slip LSD to people. It is stunning how much power Gottlieb had, but it originates with Eisenhower in many respects and what he was willing to approve.
You're right that there's an impression of Eisenhower as being a very gentle kind of grandfatherly figure. But Eisenhower was an intense and strong supporter of covert action. He probably was the last president who honestly believed that you could get away with this stuff and nobody would ever find out. I interviewed a guy who was in the CIA at that time, and he told me if you'd gone up to Eisenhower and said to him something like, "I don't understand why you sent the CIA to overthrow the government of Guatemala," he would look you right in the eye and say, "I have no idea what you're talking about." Now, why was Eisenhower such a strong supporter of covert action? I think a lot of it has to do with his background in World War II. We don't know, of course, because Eisenhower never either explained why he supported covert action or even mentioned that he did. Mm-hmm. But in World War II, Eisenhower had to send kids off to die by the thousands. This must have weighed on him. He saw covert action as essentially a peace project. Overthrowing governments and letting the CIA work covertly was the alternative to war in his mind. So when he said in his famous speech at the end of his presidency that we must beware of the growth of influence for the military-industrial complex, I think the subtext, which isn't always understood, is we should give more power to our covert agencies. Let them do things secretly. That way we won't have to have a military-industrial complex. Now, you talked about his unwillingness to supervise Sidney Gottlieb. You're absolutely right. Gottlieb carried out for years the most extreme experiments on human subjects that have ever been carried out by any officer or agency of the U.S. government. Almost nobody knew what he was doing. Probably the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, and his immediate supervisor, effectively Richard Helms, had a good idea. But they responded to it in a way quite different from the way you or I might respond. So they understood. that Gottlieb had been given a job, this mind control job, that probably would require him to carry out intense, grotesque experiments on people. They understood that this must mean people were suffering, that blood was spilled, that some victims would die. And as they came to understand, at least at some level, how intense MKUltra was, rather than decide, well, if all these extreme things are going on, carried out by somebody who works for me, I better be sure I know what's going on, they decided the opposite. They decided that since they realized how awful the project must be, they didn't want to know anything about it. This is obedience, I think, not just to CIA culture, but probably culture in other secret services as well. At a certain point, ignorance is an asset. You don't want to know too much. It implicates you. It makes you have to lie when you're asked about whether you know things. And then later on, it exposes you to the possibility of sharing responsibility. So for this reason, Gottlieb was allowed to carry out this extreme and in many cases quite bizarre and bloody project with almost no supervision.
Would it be unfair to compare him to Dr. Joseph Mengele, the Nazi doctor who did all kinds of experiments on live humans?
When Gottlieb started his work, he decided that before you could figure out how to put a new mind into somebody's brain, you first had to find a way to blast away the mind that was in there. That's why his experiments became so grotesque, because if you're trying to find a way to destroy a human mind and a human spirit and a human body, you have to experiment in some pretty grotesque ways. So also with his scientific approach, Gottlieb then asked himself, what research is still is already available out there? Who already is experienced in finding ways to destroy human beings? And they decided that there certainly would be a good store of knowledge among the old Nazi doctors who carried out those gruesome experiments in concentration camps and with their Japanese counterparts who did things that in some ways were even more awful. So the CIA actually hired Nazi doctors to work with MKUltra. We didn't just build on their experiments in the camps. We invited them in to tell us what they had done and to help us shape the experiments that were going to be carried out on these most unfortunate victims. So Mengele was, of course, nowhere to be found in this period. On the other hand, several other important Nazis did come to work for the CIA, and one of them was Kurt Bloma, who was the chief of the biological warfare department of the Nazi army. Another one was the surgeon general of the Nazi army. These people came to work for the United States, and this leads me to think that maybe Mengele might have miscalculated. He figured that after everything he had done in the concentration camps, he and people like Kurt Bloma would have to run or they'd be captured and executed. But that might not have been true. Kurt Bloma, the guy we did hire, was put on trial at Nuremberg for war crimes. But the CIA got to the judges at Nuremberg, who were all American military officers, and essentially told them, we don't want to hang this guy. We want to hire him. And I suspect that if Mengele had not run away and had surrendered to the Americans, he might well have wound up as a welcome colleague with Sidney Gottlieb and the other chemists of MKUltra.
And Stephen, this is where your book and together with David Talbot's work in The Devil's Chessboard shows that there was a huge side exit door at the Nuremberg trials. And we had our OSS people as the CIA was yet to be formed. But they were tagging certain individuals for preferential treatment and basically to identify them as not subject to the death penalty. And this undermines the credibility of the United States and the entire Nuremberg proceedings.
You're absolutely right. And at the Japanese proceedings, we were even able to get the guys off before they were even put on trial. We were able to arrange that the worst criminals who we wanted to work with were not even indicted. one of the odd aspects of Sidney Gottlieb's work as the director of MK Ultra has to do with this Nazi connection. So Gottlieb was Jewish. His parents immigrated from Central Europe to the United States in the early 20th century. If they hadn't done that, if they had stayed in Europe, they might well have been arrested by Nazi occupiers, and young Sidney might have wound up as the victim of one of these gruesome concentration camp experiments. Instead, he didn't seem to have any problem working shoulder to shoulder with the very same doctors who carried out those experiments.
And one of the elements that you touch on in the book was the experimentation based on Japanese developments during the World War II period in the weaponization of insects. And in particular, there is now emerging evidence and additional documentation to support the contentions that were made by American pilots who were then written off as brainwashed by the Korean captors. But they said they flew missions where they dropped packages with fleas, which were infected with bubonic plague. And this was a real low point in chemical biological warfare, which we always distance ourselves from and make it seem like the United States would never go that low. And that's not something that would ever be considered American.
Well, the entire MK Ultra project, just like the germ warfare allegations in Korea, raises a very deep question. And that is one that I think Gottlieb, who ran MK Ultra, lost sight of. So is there an amount of evil that you can do in what you believe is a good cause before the evil begins to outweigh the good? Commitment to a great cause is the greatest justification for committing immoral acts. And patriotism is among the most sublime and seductive of causes. So that could be something that ties the Gottlieb's era to our era. Back in the 50s, we were being told that although we were this good, innocent nation that never wanted to hurt anyone, there are some moments when for a brief period we have to face an unusually fierce threat, and then we have to do things that we might not otherwise do and give up some freedoms we might normally want to guard. That was true in the 50s, and I think a version of that is true today. We also are being told that because of unusual threats that the United States faces, we can't have all the civil liberties that we deserve and or that we're used to having, and we must carry out operations in other parts of the world, that the details of which we never actually find out. So I think at least for me, the process of uncovering the story of this totally invisible individual who was so powerful that he actually had a license to kill issued by the U.S. government and was conducting experiments across three continents in secret definitely makes me wonder, would he have been the only one? Is there somebody else unknown that I didn't find? Or what about today? Who knows, with all of the advances of technology, what's going on behind that facade right now? So certainly going into the story of Sidney Gottlieb and realizing how much of what might be considered crazy conspiracy theory actually winds up being true when you read about MK Ultra does lead you to wonder what else is out there.
Well, and if you'll indulge me for a moment and we'll step outside the frame of the book, Dick Cheney, after 9/11, infamously said, "We've got to go to the dark side." And we started torturing people. And there was a whole manual written during the Gottlieb, Helms, Dulles era at the CIA called KUBARK. And it was the manual on how to torture people and how to resist torture. And so I still scratch my head and wonder why they felt the need to pay $82 million to Mitchell and Jessen, these psychologists who were hired as consultants to develop and manage the Bush-era torture program, because the book was already on the shelf, Stephen.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, this definitely is one of the legacies of Sidney Gottlieb today. So during the 1950s, he conducted these relentless experiments with drugs and electroshock and sensory deprivation and all kinds of other torments. They were all aimed at trying to find a way to dissolve the subject's connection to the outside world and to his or her own personality, to make them abandon everything that they knew and everything that they were. He wrote up a memo explaining the best ways to do this after his years of experience. That memo then became the basis of this Kubark manual that you talked about. It became the basis for manuals that were given to Latin American police forces during the 1980s.
At the School of the Americas.
Turned up in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And in some cases, you can actually trace the phrases right from Gottlieb's memo all the way up to the present day. So what we now call enhanced interrogation definitely traces some of its roots back to this extraordinary figure of Sidney Gottlieb.
Just a little fine note on the way you put air quotes on enhanced interrogation. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has determined that torture is the appropriate term. But in the military tribunals at Guantanamo, it is still referred to as enhanced interrogation.
I think the reason for that has to do with international law. If it's torture, certain provisions of various treaties are triggered. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of something that happened during the Rwandan genocide when the United States didn't want to accept that genocide was happening because that would force certain actions. And the poor State Department spokeswoman had to get up and say that there had been acts of genocide committed in Rwanda. And the reporters kept asking, how many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
Yeah.
So it's all a kind of a verbal gymnastics when everybody understands what these practices mean and what we would call them if anybody else used them.
Well, and the Turks and Armenians are still fighting over the terminology of genocide over 100 years after the incidents. So
you're right. It would seem like no group is satisfied having been the victims of mass murder or Holocaust. It has to be a genocide, otherwise you don't really count. So sometimes I think we devote so much attention to the phraseology, we lose sight of what actually happened and the horrific nature of the event.
We're talking with journalist and author Stephen Kinzer. His new book is Prisoner in Chief, a biography of Sidney Gottlieb. And I really have to recommend the book to people who have followed the story of Frank Olson. I first learned about it from the work of H.P. Alborelli Jr. Hank Alborelli passed away this past summer, and his contributions, I think, were quite significant. He wrote a book, almost 900 pages, rich in detail about the episode. You managed to add some new information to my knowledge of that and to put it in a slightly broader context of what was going on with Gottlieb, the experiments with LSD in the early 1950s, and also the new documentary that is available on Netflix, Errol Morris's Wormwood, is an excellent recounting of the Olson story. But for those who aren't familiar with it, could you give us a quick thumbnail of Frank Olson, his work at Fort Detrick, and what led to his death, which was called a suicide, but is widely believed to have been a CIA assassination, or at least a murder plot?
Sidney Gottlieb, the head of MKUltra, was the chief CIA chemist. He worked with a very small group of scientists carrying out this project. And the fact that it was named MKUltra was not an accident. Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, considered it to be the Ultra project. It was the most important thing the CIA did or could possibly do if the CIA, after all, could find a way to control people's minds. Then other successes of that era, like overthrowing the government of Iran, would seem insignificant by comparison. That's why this project was so important. The people involved in it knew the deepest and darkest secrets of the Cold War. That's one reason why the group was kept so small, because security was so vital. Then, much to the unhappiness of Gottlieb and the group, one member of the group had an attack of conscience. That was Frank Olson. He was one of the chemists who had worked on this project from the very beginning. He also had been involved at Fort Detrick even during World War II. Fort Detrick was the biological weapons center of the U.S., so if the United States had indeed used germ warfare in Korea, which we've always denied, Frank Olson definitely would have known about it and probably would have been involved. In the summer of 1953, while working on MKUltra, Frank Olson made a trip to Europe. The people working with Gottlieb, and Gottlieb himself, used to make these trips regularly to go out and observe the torture sessions that they had dreamed up for these poor expendables, as the victims in Europe and East Asia were called. So on this visit to Europe, Frank Olson watched people being tortured, and by some accounts apparently tortured to death, using poisons that he himself, Olson, had created. Suddenly, this got to be too much for him. He didn't want to do it anymore. He was upset. He told this to people. When he got back to the United States, he even told some of his CIA colleagues that he wanted to quit, wants to quit the CIA. We later discovered that he even asked one friend if he knew a good journalist. So this was something that was a terrible threat inside MKUltra. And not so long after returning from his troubling trip to Europe, on a November night in 1953, Frank Olson went out the window of a 13th floor hotel room in New York City and plunged to his death. So that was described at the moment, at the time, as the suicide of an army scientist. So he was not an army scientist, and suicide has now been called more and more into question. That suicide explanation stood more or less unchallenged for 22 years. Then, in 1975, the CIA admitted that there was another piece of the story they had not made public. It was that a week before Frank Olson died, Gottlieb had invited him to a retreat with other members of the group and had surreptitiously dosed his drink with LSD. So this put a whole new twist on things, and it suggested that Frank Olson had a terrible reaction to this LSD, and that was what had caused him to jump out the window. So the president of the United States actually invited Olson's family into the Oval Office and apologized on behalf of the U.S. government and the CIA, something that has never happened before.
And Stephen, I just want to reference that I was doing a radio show in Chicago at the time, and I'd focused a lot on Watergate. And, of course, this is Gerald Ford who is exposing these misdeeds. But it was another limited hangout, because I remember it basically as a one-day news story, and that Ford had had the family in and made a conciliatory public statement. But it wasn't really until the recent past that this started to fit in, and I was able to see the pattern of the deception.
You're right. So the first story was a guy gets depressed, jumps out the window. Then 22 years later, we find out he wasn't just depressed. He was made depressed because the CIA put LSD in his drink, and that made him crazy, and that's why he jumped out the window. But then, years later, another version began to unfold. So the family finally had the body exhumed. They'd been told that his body was so badly mauled in the fall, they couldn't look at it. When they opened it up, it didn't look mauled at all, but it had a big bruise right over the forehead. And later on, the so-called assassination manual of the CIA was uncovered, written by Gottlieb, apparently. And it says that one of the best ways to kill someone is to throw him from a great height after you've immobilized him with a blow to the forehead. Meanwhile, one of the detectives who had worked on the case has gone back into that hotel room and surveyed it and concluded that the story that Frank Olson ran across the room and then dived through this very narrow window seems highly unlikely. So the family is now definitely convinced that Frank Olson was helped out that window. And if that's true, for which there's considerable, at least circumstantial evidence, then there's no doubt that Sidney Gottlieb, as head of MK Ultra, would certainly have been involved, along with other people at the CIA.
And I don't know what is next in your book writing queue, Stephen, but Harold Abramson is a murky figure who was the doctor that they sent Frank Olson to. And Abramson, it was an allergist. So his connection to the CIA is more expansive in your book than I have seen before. And I think that there could be much more behind Abramson's connections with Gottlieb than we know so far.
In my book, my favorite line, it comes at the very end. I say, everything in this book is true, but not everything that's true is in this book. I'm painfully aware that I have only discovered a portion of what MK Ultra was and what Sidney Gottlieb did. I think I've taken the story further than anyone else, but this was such an intensely secret project, and Gottlieb was so successful in destroying records as he went out the door that there are many pieces of this that lead to speculation like the speculation you just offered. And it's truly an endlessly fascinating story, and I think you could say, considering the drug aspect of it, literally mind-boggling.
Indeed, yeah. For example, I had never heard before that Whitey Bulger, who is a now infamous former Boston gangster who was caught in Santa Monica and put on trial, and he tried to expose his arrangement with the FBI that allowed him to be a paid informant while he continued to be a mob killer. But what was fascinating is his disclosure that he volunteered for a program while he was doing a stretch in a prison in Atlanta. And this was one of Gottlieb's ways of getting candidates or subjects to test these drugs on. And it's astounding. You report that Bulger was, let me turn the page here, he was given LSD nearly every day for 15 months without being told what it was. He wrote afterward that he had nightly nightmares, horrible LSD experiences, followed by thoughts of suicide and deep depression. And I'm wondering if any of that ever came out in the Boston trial that led to his sentence, that led to his murder in prison.
It did not, and that was somewhat controversial. Some people thought that since the evidence that Bulger had committed these murders was quite strong, maybe a good defense would be the CIA destroyed my mind while I was a prisoner. That did not come up, but the Bulger story is one way that we can get into a piece of what MKUltra was. I mentioned earlier that Gottlieb was looking for ways to destroy a person's mind. Abroad, his subjects, who could often be experimented on to death, because the U.S. had that ability in countries that we controlled, the subjects were what they called expendable, so suspected enemy agents or captured prisoners of war or refugees who didn't seem to be connected to anybody and wouldn't be missed if they disappeared. But in the U.S., Gottlieb's favorite subjects for drug experiments were prisoners, for obvious reasons. And it turned out that one of these was Whitey Bulger, who later wrote about it. So when he was still in his 20s, back in the 50s, when Gottlieb was carrying out this MK Ultra project in total secrecy, Whitey Bulger was approached by the doctor in the prison where he was being incarcerated for truck hijacking, and that was in Atlanta. The doctor told him, we're doing experiments seeking to find a cure for schizophrenia, and we would love your help, and we will give you a better treatment in jail and easy time and so forth if you volunteer. So he volunteered, and he never really understood what was happening to him. And he was given LSD every day, as you just mentioned, for more than a year. This naturally has a very disturbing effect on a person's psyche. And when you multiply that times all the other prisons and the other prisoners on whom Gottlieb conducted his MKUltra experiments, you get a sense for the trail of shattered lives that he left behind.
And, Stephen, I referenced earlier that Gottlieb engaged with a host of shady characters to carry out this work. And one of them is this guy, George Hunter White, who was here in San Francisco running a safe house, had a bedroom with a two-way mirror, and it was wired to film and record. They used hookers to bring people to the safe house and then secretly gave them LSD. There's also one just about 10 minutes from where I sit in Mill Valley, which is just north of San Francisco. And the idea that he could work with these people, openly violate the law on a regular basis and never get caught, never get exposed, is quite remarkable.
You're quite right. The San Francisco operation was another one of these bizarre, extreme ideas that Gottlieb came up with. Later on, he said that he had used LSD more than 200 times. And sometimes I wonder about these experiments that he conceived. Did he invent some of them while he was tripping? Because some of them are so outlandish, you'd wonder what any other possible explanation could be. The one in San Francisco responded to one of Gottlieb's ideas that it would be interesting to see if drugs in conjunction with sex would be useful in ways of making people talk more freely. So he hired this guy, George Hunter White, who by day was a federal narcotics agent, but was famous for his own drug and alcohol consumption. And he asked him to set up what amounted to a bordello on Telegraph Hill in San Francisco. And so it was all decorated with kind of bordello chic and Toulouse-Lautrec paintings and manacles that were in the drawers. And there the girls would bring men back and they would give them drinks that George Hunter White had dosed with either LSD or whatever other drug Gottlieb wanted to test that week. And then White would sit on the other side of the one-way mirror on his portable toilet, drinking martinis out of his pitcher, and write notes about what was happening in the other room. This was called Operation Midnight Climax. And essentially, it's your tax dollars at work trying to find a way for the U.S. to defend itself against communism.
And, Stephen, it's fair to say that Sid Gottlieb was the father of the merry pranksters, that his experimentation and the CIA had the biggest stash of LSD in the world at a certain point in the 50s and 60s, and one of the locations where they were testing it on patients was at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Menlo Park, California, and I used to live right down the street from that place. And we know that Ken Kesey and others who had odd jobs there working as janitors were able to access the inventory. And that's really what led to the hippie experimentations with LSD and the widespread use that followed.
Perhaps Gottlieb's most amazing legacy is that he really unwittingly became the godfather of the whole LSD counterculture. He's the guy who brought LSD to the United States. He was fascinated with LSD. He thought it could be the key to mind control. In 1953, he persuaded the CIA to buy the entire world supply of LSD from the company that made it in Switzerland. He did two things with that stash. One is he used it for these horrific experiments in prisons and other places, as we were just discussing. But there was another side to his LSD experimenting. He wanted to see how ordinary people would respond to taking LSD in a clinical setting. since the CIA didn't have any clinics, Gottlieb set up a couple of bogus medical foundations that contacted hospitals and clinics around the United States and told them, we want to hire you, we want to pay you to call for volunteers to come in and try this new psychoactive drug, and then we'll give you the drug for free. You just have to write down notes about how people respond. So almost overnight, the whole market for those experiments grew up. And who were some of the first people who came in to try Gottlieb's LSD? One was, as you just mentioned, Ken Kesey, who took it at the Menlo Park VA hospital. He liked it so much that he not only told his friends to go and volunteer and try it, but he did get a job at that hospital, which gave him the experiences he needed to write that great book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But I discovered in my research that that was just an accident. He really got the job for another reason, which was so that he could steal the LSD and bring it home and have these parties. Allen Ginsberg, the poet, also was turned on by Sidney Gottlieb and an MK Ultra at Stanford, another guy who took MK Ultra LSD and psilocybin at Stanford was Robert Hunter, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. All these people then brought it home and told their friends to go and do it. From there, LSD leaked out into the counterculture. And so the irony, of course, is that the drug that Sidney Gottlieb thought would give the CIA the ability to control human minds wound up fueling a generational rebellion that was aimed at destroying everything the CIA stands for.
Now, picking up on what you just mentioned there, Mr. Kinzer, are you now or ever have you been a deadhead?
Absolutely. I'm old enough to have been a real deadhead, not the one that has to go and look at the copycat band. So, yes, I look back very warmly on my experiences with the Grateful Dead, and it was kind of nice in this book to reconnect with them in an odd way. So Robert Hunter, the lyricist, later said that he realized that in a way the Grateful Dead were a creation of the U.S. government. And what he would have said if he had been able to read my book is that they were not so much a creation of the U.S. government as a creation of Sidney Gottlieb. I found a quote from John Lennon. He was asked about LSD. And he said, we must always remember to thank the CIA. If he had known more, he would have said, we must always remember to thank Sidney Gottlieb. He is the real unknown godfather of LSD in America.
Now, you don't make any confessions about personal use in the book, but I will. I have tried LSD a few times. It's been about 30 years since I took a trip. But I have to say that it was a delightful experience, a little scary because of all the negative attitude that had been, you know, kind of burned into my consciousness beforehand. But it really was a mind-opening, I wouldn't call it mind-blowing, but a mind-opening experience. And the best way I can describe it is like an old-fashioned ice tray, where before the ice forms, you lift the divider out of it, and it kind of removes the false partitions between the different cubes of ice. And I reference this not just to, you know, say that I tried LSD, but we are seeing a whole new wave of interest in this drug as a beneficial treatment for PTSD and for other forms of mental illness. And so in some respects, Gottlieb's work has come full circle, and there is a new awareness and respect for LSD as a medication here in 2019 than there was even just a few years ago.
You're absolutely right. LSD is back. And in a way, it's like Gottlieb coming back for a curtain call. The difference is that when LSD was invented in 1943 by accident, the chemist who invented it, Albert Hofmann, decided that its best use might be to treat mental illness. And for a short time, it was used for therapeutic purposes. Gottlieb, however, was only interested in using it for covert action. And then, of course, as you point out, in the 60s, it was demonized as the drug that would cause everything from birth defects to insanity. It was made illegal and put on Schedule One. But now, finally, after so much time has passed, I think we are starting to get back to Albert Hofmann's original ideas. There have been several books out now about the value of LSD in various kinds of therapy. Denver has just voted in May to legalize the magic mushrooms that have psilocybin in them. That could set a precedent for other cities and states. Johns Hopkins Medical School has just announced an amazing project. They've gotten $17 million to open a new institute for the study of psychedelic drugs and their effect on consciousness. This is the first time that's ever happened in the United States. There's even going to be a musical on Broadway this spring, written by James Lapine, the guy who wrote that Sunday in the Park with George and has won the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Awards. It's about how Claire Booth Luce, Cary Grant, and Aldous Huxley used LSD in the 1950s. So there's no doubt that there's now a rebirth of interest in LSD. And it's a very good moment to look back and realize that the person who first brought LSD to the U.S. was not some merry prankster, but the guy who turned on the merry pranksters, and that was somebody who was working for the CIA, Sidney Gottlieb.
The book is called Poisoner in Chief. I blew that. Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. There's much more in the book, and I highly recommend it. But before you go, Stephen Kinzer, I wanted to ask you to share some of your commentary from recent columns that you've written for the Boston Globe. I do occasionally see people post them on Facebook, and so I've followed your work on and off for several years now. First up, I wanted to ask you about a recent piece you wrote about Senator Elizabeth Warren. She is on the ascendancy in the Democratic primary, and I find her an attractive candidate, but I am concerned about her foreign policy positions and what I find to be a kind of Me Too approach, an Israel First approach. And I don't feel confident in her approach to the duties of Commander-in-Chief. What is your take on Senator Warren? She is your junior senator there.
I agree with your observation. I'm sympathetic to her confrontation with American oligarchy to the extent that that's what it is. But I don't see how you can ever decouple that from what we're doing abroad. Those projects that Elizabeth Warren and other progressive Democrats support, like wiping out college debt and having Medicare for all, are expensive. The place to get that money is all the billions and hundreds of billions that we're spending on our foreign wars. You can't talk about domestic inequality without talking about how much of our national assets are being poured into wars that not only don't produce the results we want, but are undermining our own security. So Elizabeth Warren, you're right, has not said anything particularly interesting about world affairs. She seems to be fitting right into the paradigm in ways that she doesn't fit when it comes to domestic politics. It reflects something I think that's characteristic of American politics. It's remarkable how many people in Washington can spend so many years and decades in high public office and really never think seriously about world affairs. When you don't think much about it, you just swallow the cliches, which is that the world's such a dangerous place. The United States has to be active everywhere. We have to be fighting all over the world. If we don't fight them there, they're going to come here. And whenever there's trouble in the world, the United States has to swing into action, choose sides, and intervene. It's kind of the default view. And I'm always impressed with how powerful is the force in Washington that draws everybody who comes there into this deadening foreign policy consensus. Just about all Democrats, just about all Republicans, just about every think tank, and most of the press, all falls into this. It didn't take long for Obama to buy into it, for Trump to buy into it. There's some very powerful force, maybe it's something in the water in Washington, that makes people want to support the foreign policy we've been following since the end of the Cold War, which has brought nothing but trouble for us and the world while bankrupting us at home. So, yes, I feel that there's a big hole in Elizabeth Warren's appeal, and that is her failure to connect her critique of American domestic policy with what we're doing in the world.
Well, and I want to couple that with one of my regular themes, which is media malpractice. And we see the way the networks are staging these debates, like sporting events or, you know, wrestling matches. And, for example, in the most recent Democratic debate, foreign policy was given very short shrift, and Jorge Ramos asked a very loaded question only of Bernie Sanders about Venezuela, and it was designed to force him to denounce the Maduro government and to separate himself from what is viewed as its failed socialist enterprise. And I was really screaming at my TV set because there are significant issues there. The American people have been sold a whole lot of bullshit about Venezuela, and the bipartisan consensus that regime change is the answer is just stunning to me, yet the network anchors are oblivious to it, and it was mostly treated as a gotcha question for Sanders.
You're absolutely right. So I think it's right to blame the candidates and politicians for not having developed positions and not having thought much about these questions. But the greater blame, as you point out, lies with the networks and the people that they choose to ask the questions. In fact, if you don't know or care anything about the world, and you just think we should keep on stumbling destructively around the world as we do right now, nobody's going to challenge you. So they're not going to ask the question, so why would you have to think deeply about these issues? So you're absolutely right. The media creates a climate that discourages politicians from taking positions on world affairs, and particularly any position that seems to question the American hegemony approach to the world. So I blame the networks and the people they choose, who are all part of this in-group, at least as much as I blame the candidates themselves.
Well, and the structure of these debates is so infuriating. They try to pit one candidate against another. So, you know, in the last one, Amy Klobuchar, who's more conservative on health care policy, was teed up to try to slam Sanders and Warren for Medicare for All. And what ended up was, in a two-hour debate, more than 30 minutes being devoted to dueling bullet points. You know, I got more bullet points in my health care plan than you do. And all of this is just speculative. And it's fine for the candidates to define what their goals and aspirations are. But when they get into the weeds of, you know, comparing your deductibles with my deductibles, none of this is real. It has to pass through Congress. And so
I completely agree with you. I got so frustrated watching them go into detail after detail on their health care problems. And I'm thinking about, what about Syria? What about Yemen? What about Iran? What about the problems that we're facing with Russia? What about nuclear issues? What about climate? You don't get any of this as we talk about how big the deductible should be for people in which size of company. And I do, again, blame the media and the networks who are actually expressing the main consensus in Washington. It's not in their interest to challenge it, and they don't.
Stephen, finally, as we're speaking today, it's October 7th, President Trump has announced that he essentially is yielding to Turkey and is telling U.S. forces not to intervene, as Turkey is likely to ravage the Kurds who are cornered in that section of Syria along the Turkish border. And this is bringing up a lot of kind of blowback and recrimination. And fundamentally, I take the position that U.S. troops never should have been there. We never should have been involved in this proxy war in Syria, even to the limited extent of our troop deployments. But the covert operations, the funding of the so-called moderate, I can't avoid laughing when I think of Obama, you know, burning through billions of dollars to train 30 people who melted away behind this notion of a moderate Syrian resistance. And so the whole thing is a very tragic cartoon. And I support Trump's instincts here to get U.S. troops out. At the same time, I feel that the Kurds, who were reliable mercenaries for the United States throughout this episode, are once again going to be left to die.
You're right about Trump. Sometimes I find it odd that he seems, for example, to want to have better relations with Russia, but he surrounds himself with people that hate Russia. He seems not to have any particular animus against Iran, but he surrounds himself with people that hate Iran. So I'm hoping at some point maybe we could let Trump be Trump and follow his own instincts. Maybe that's what he's doing in Syria right now. So I agree with you that the original sin was going in there in the first place. We never should have picked sides. Every time you pick sides in a battle on the other side of the world or anywhere else, you're not only making friends, but you're making enemies. And we've spent so much time making enemies in that part of the world, we can hardly keep them straight anymore. So we should not have gotten involved and started picking sides. The Kurds, I hate to say it, and they should have known this from their history, were foolish to trust us. We've never carried out our commitments to them in the past, and they know this. And American policy is just not reliable. I can see why they took a stab in the dark, but it didn't pay off for them. Now, I think the Kurds have decided that since they are not self-sufficient in that area that they control, they don't have an air force, they don't have a big enough population, that their best bet with America leaving is to make a deal with the Assad government. And I think they were in the process of doing that. But the Americans are still so obsessed with getting rid of Assad, and they hate Assad so much, they would rather obstruct the Kurds' process of reconciliation with Assad than allow him to do that. And the way they're obstructing it is going to be quite violent, because we're essentially allowing Turkey to storm into that region. So I think, given the fact that we made the mistake of getting into Syria in the first place, we should be withdrawing. But it should be with a clear understanding with Turkey and, yes, also with Syria about how to take care of the Kurds. We're so anti-Assad that we can't bring ourselves to do what would be best for the Kurds, which is to encourage them to reintegrate themselves into the Syrian state. Instead, we're exposing them to the prospect of terrible violence. And just another example of how short-sighted we are, and also how these foreign interventions always end up having unanticipated consequences. And we keep telling ourselves, this time we'll get it right. In the meantime, people die and our billions are wasted in Middle Eastern sand.
And we remain mired 18 years on in Afghanistan. And similarly, you know, we don't have significant troop presence or even troops plus mercenaries there to accomplish anything today. Yet, inevitably, if Trump does decide to pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, we are going to hear blowback about the plight of women there. And it tugs on my heart, I have to say. I know that returning Afghanistan to some form of Islamic rule will not be good for the female population. But we cannot stay in Afghanistan forever, and we cannot prevent those cultural realities from occurring.
With that kind of an attitude, you won't be able to get a drink in Washington, D.C., I can tell you. You're way off the paradigm.
Well, I haven't been spending much time in the Beltway lately.
You won't be welcome there any more than I am. I tell you, I go to Washington as rarely as possible, but whenever I do, I'm struck by how narrow is the spectrum of acceptable opinions on world affairs. Either you have to be a bomb everybody yesterday type like Cheney and Rumsfeld, or you have to be we have to save the world like Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power. Anybody outside that, anybody who questions the idea that America should run the world, is seen as kind of a strange, as John McCain called us, a wacko bird. And I'm hoping that slowly a new consensus can begin to emerge, but so much is invested in the permanent war paradigm in Washington that it's going to take a pretty heavy sledgehammer to begin to weaken it.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, thanks for your time today. I feel that I've met a fellow wacko bird. I want to thank you for Poisoner in Chief. I think it's an excellent book that expanded my knowledge of these issues, and I hope we can talk again.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with journalist and author Stephen Kinzer. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.